I'd like to go ahead and call this meeting to order for the afternoon session. It's 7 minutes after 1 p.m., April 9th, 2012. Joined today by Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Thomas, and myself, Stedman. We have two items on today. First, we're going to bring up SB 163, Geo Bond for Ports and Other Things, and then we'll have a brief at ease, and then we'll have a short conversation on the oil bill, HB 192, oil and gas production tax, Senate Bill 163 by the governor regarding geo bonds for ports. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to adopt a committee substitute, have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. Senator Hoffman may have a motion to adopt the committee substitute version D.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 163, version D, as our working document.
And I'll object for explanation and ask Mr. Idler to come forward, please. You can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then walk us through this. The CS changes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, Weston Eiler, staff to the Senate Finance Committee. Before you this afternoon is the committee substitute for Senate Bill 163. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I just outlined the changes that the committee made in the CS. Again, on work draft /D. Beginning on line 1, page 1, Mr. Chairman, there's a title change for the bill. Revising the title to an act providing for and relating to the issuance of general obligation bonds for the purpose of paying the cost of state transportation projects. The committee substitute broadens the bill to cover not only ports but state transportation issues. The second change on the same page, line 10, adjusts the amount of issuance of the general obligation bonds to $453,499,200. And this is to reflect the cost of issuance of the bonds, which will be explained in a later section of the bill. Beginning on page 2, Mr. Chairman, line 1, section 2, it renames the project fund from which revenues authorized by the general obligation bond would be centered. That is on line 3, renaming it the 2012 State Transportation Project Fund. The second change on that page, Mr. Chairman, is section 3, beginning on line 8. It specifies a new amount that would go to the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development of $188,400,000. It also broadens the statutes under which these grants would be awarded to recipients, beginning on line 13, adds an additional statute of AS35.05.316. Beginning on line 16, Mr. Chairman, the committee substitute replaces the projects listed in both the governor's and the Senate Transportation Committee substitute for the following projects. Again, beginning on line 16, Port of Anchorage expansion, $50 million, Bethel Harbor dredging, $4 million, Bristol Bay Borough, Port of Bristol Bay expansion and pile dock replacement, $7 million. Hainesboro Boat Harbor upgrades, $12 million. Kodiak Pier 3 replacement, $15 million. Kotzebue Cape Blossom Road and Port, $10 million. Manuska Susitna Borough, Bogard Road Extension East, $13.5 million. Matanuska Susitna Borough Port McKenzie Rail Extension, $30 million. Nanana Tatatchakik Resource Development Corridor Access, $6.5 million. Newtok Traditional Council, Matarvik Evacuation Road Construction, $4.1 million. Nome Port Design and Construction, $10 million. Continuing on to page 3, Mr. Chairman, line 1, Sandpoint Road Rehabilitation, $2.5 million. Seward Marine Industrial Center Expansion, $10 million. Sitka Sawmill Cove Industrial Park, $7.5 million. St. George Harbor Reconstruction, $3 million. Togiak Waterfront Transit Facility, $3.3 million. Mr. Chairman, in Section 4, following right after that, beginning on line 6, It adds a new section by which the Department of Transportation, under the appropriate statute AS37.07.08E, would be authorized to spend from the 2012 State Port Transportation Fund for the following amounts. This is a new section that was not included in either version of the previous bill. And under that authorization, would appropriate the following, or authorize the appropriation of the following, for the following projects: Anchorage, Glen Highway, Highland Road, and Artillery Road reconstruction, $35 million. Anchorage, Glen Highway, Muldoon Road interchange reconstruction, $15 million. Anchorage, New Seward Highway, 36th Avenue reconstruction, $26 million. Anchorage, New Seward Highway, milepost 75 to 90 bridge repairs, $10 million. Anchorage O'Malley Road reconstruction, $15 million. Fairbanks Elliott Highway, milepost 108 to 120 reconstruction. Fairbanks Old Steese Highway to McGrath Road reconstruction, $24 million. Fairbanks Wendell Street Bridge replacement, $14.4 million. Haynes Maintenance Shop replacement, $3 million. Juneau Glacier Highway, milepost 4 to 6, improvements, $5.5 million. Juneau Mendenhall Loop Road Improvements, $6 million. Kenai Spur Road Rehabilitation, $20 million. Ketchikan Shelter Road Construction, $19 million. Continuing on to page 4, Mr. Chairman. Matsu Fairview Loop Road Reconstruction, $10 million. Matsu Knick Goose Bay Road Reconstruction, $15 million. North Pole Plaque Road Improvements, $5 million. Platinum Airport Road Extension, $3.1 million. Port Clarence Access Improvements, $4 million. Richardson Highway, Ruby Creek Bridge Replacement, $11 million. Sitka-Catlin Bay Road Construction, $14 million. Mr. Chairman, under the committee substitute, the following sections are also renumbered in a little bit order. In the current CS, Section 5 is instructions and authorization for the State Bond Committee. The new amount of $3,599,200 is added there with the following language: if the issuance of the bonds is ratified by a majority of the quality voters of the state who vote on the question, the amount of $3,599,200, or as much of that amount as found necessary, is appropriated from the 2012 State Transportation Project Fund of the state to the bond committee to carry out the provisions of this act and pay for the expenses incident to the sale and issuance of bonds authorized in this act. The section 6 below it is also cleanup language related to instructions for the state bond committee. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the summary changes for the committee substitute, the last change being in section 7. With the ballot question, with the amount put to the Alaska voters to reflect the total authorized in the committee substitute for Senate Bill 163. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and I will go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Do we have further objection to the adoption of the CS?
Mr. Chairman. Seeing,
you have objection?
Just a question, actually, more than an objection. So no objection, but just on the page 3, line 23, the Elliott Highway project indicated as Fairbanks. That project is I realize this is a big state, that project is 118 miles by road from Fairbanks, so I think it should probably read Minto or something other than Fairbanks, actually. So, because the Elliott Highway starts 10 miles out of Fairbanks, and that particular project starts at 108 mile on the Elliott, so that would make it starting 118 miles from Fairbanks. So
maybe we can work on some kind of a language issue later on.
Sure.
We'll thank bring you. Back. There's another change that's under discussion also. I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Any further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, that's our working document. If we can have Ms. pretty much presents the bill. If we can have Ms. Rayfield come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Karen Rayfield, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. Mr. Chairman, as you know, the governor's original proposal was $350 million for general obligation bonds for port projects. These are important infrastructure projects around the state. There were six items in the original bill. All but two of those are incorporated in the CS that was just adopted before the committee. And there was one that had a title change and one that had a little bit of a dollar amount change. I know that it's in play with the capital budget as well. Also, Mr. Chairman, in the room is Deputy Commissioner Rodell from Revenue to speak to the fiscal note, if that's your desire today.
Ms. Rodell, you want to come forward, please?
For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. Before you, you have a fiscal note which contemplates the issuance of $453 million, of which $3.5 million will be used for costs of issuance associated with issuing these bonds. The plan is that the first issuance would occur in February after the ballot initiative is approved by the voters in November. And then we would continue with issuances in fiscal year 14 and fiscal year 16. The plan is for that is to make sure that all the bond proceeds are used in a timely manner and that we are not sitting on any funds that can't be invested into the projects immediately. We're expecting a low cost of funds. The market continues to cooperate, and we would be looking at probably a blended all-in cost of about 2.6% for the first bond issuance. These projects are long-term in nature. We expect a 20-year bond issue, and we would finance long-lived projects over that 20-year period. It will allow us to use cash for more expensive needs of the state and to give the state greater flexibility in how it finances and funds other priorities of the state. And with that, I'll turn it over to any questions you might have specific to the fiscal note or to the legislation.
Does any of the committee members have any questions for the OMB or revenue? Okay, seeing none. There's one fiscal note from the Department of Revenue for $900,000 in general funds for FY13. And with that, we'll go ahead and open up the public hearing portion. We've got several people in the off-net and some people in the Anchorage LIO. Go ahead and hold your comments to 2 minutes, please, on the bill. Start by introducing yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please. I'd like to start with Stephen Ribuoff.
Yes, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Steve Ribuoff. I'm the interim director at the Port of Anchorage. I want to thank the committee for their continued support of the Port of Anchorage Intermodal Expansion Project. We especially appreciate the additional funding included in the capital budget. While SB 163 includes $50 million for the port project, it does fall below the municipality's request of $350 million. And while the funds are a very positive step towards ensuring that this project moves forward successfully, we will be less likely able to realize all of the same efficiencies that we could achieve with increased fiscal certainty. This project is truly a statewide project, and any efficiencies and improvements to this facility benefit the majority of Alaskans who rely on it for essential goods they use every day. In closing, again, thank you. We appreciate your continued support of the project and your further positive consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Next up, Alan Joseph, please, Bethel.
Yes, I'm Alan Joseph from Sea Lion Corporation. I'm the vice chair, and I represent Hooper Bay. We work together with the city of Hooper Bay in certain projects, trying to get them started. And I'm speaking in support of SB 163, mainly because we're looking to build a small boat harbor in Hooper Bay. As you know, or as you might not know, all our barges offload at the Nugok Spit. It's a sandbar just off of Hooper Bay. And the sandbar is Hooper Bay's subsistence fishing location. residents are concerned that if anything happens to a barge that's offloading, be it an oil spill or something like that, they believe their fishing might be affected. After they offload, they truck goods to Hooper Bay by way of the beach, which is not a road. And I think that Nuuk is unprotected, not like a harbor or a dock. The dock, small boat harbor that we are looking for is valued at $8,500,000. And we're also looking for the Tumon road extension for $700,000. And we hope that you will include these items in the SB 163, which I think is also being talked about as being a transportation bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony today. Christine Klein, please.
Hello, this is Christine Klein with Calista Corporation. Thank you for allowing us to testify today, and I would like to point out that the Emonic port was in earlier versions of the bill on January 17th and February 15th, and it seems to have disappeared. The Emonic port is the hub for the mouth of the Yukon River and the villages up the Yukon River, and is relied on for fuel barges as well as the fisheries plant that provides jobs for the region. The project is currently completely designed and is ready to go to bid. It is shovel ready. I have the bid specs here even, so I'm quite surprised and a little frustrated that it's no longer showing up in the bill. We would encourage your support of this project. It is $16.5 million. Phase one, which is the dock and wharf, is $10 million, and the landing ramp is $6.4 million. As I mentioned, it is supported by the fisheries, QuickPAC, Emonic City, the Calista Regional Corporation, and the tribe in Emonic. If you have any questions, please ask. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for your testimony today. Next up, we'll go to the Anchorage LIO. Martin Moore, Senior, please.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the Senate Finance Committee. My name is Martin V. Moore, Senior. I appear before you today as the city manager of the city of Emonic. Emonic is located approximately 10 miles from the mouth of the Yukon River, and it's the regional hub for the Lower Yukon River with over 1,000 tribal residents. My services to the people of Emonic and Lower Yukon region began in 1963 when I served as the mayor of the city of Emonic. Since that time, I have served in a variety of organizations, including both Alaska Native Regional and Village Corporations, and Alaska House of Representatives, the Governor's Office, and the local school board, and multiple tribal organizations. With this background, I can personally testify to the critical importance of ensuring Alaska's goods are shipped in a reliable, efficient, and cost-effective manner. I am here to advocate for the expansion of Emonic Port and the network of ports that will benefit from Senate Bill 163. Like many rural Alaska villages, Emonic and its neighboring communities continue to struggle with the high price of fuel and necessary goods. In recent, high costs of energy have been devastating. All Alaskans are familiar with the high costs of shipping and drive prices well beyond what the average American expects to pay for basic goods. But in rural Alaska, the high price of fuel, food, and basic necessities is increasingly a matter of physical survival. Indeed, this winter, long cold snaps and high heating fuel prices have strained many Yukon Delta households to the brink of disaster and several as a reminder of our vulnerability. Expanding the Imana Port and Port Alaska Network is critical to reducing the cost of essential goods across Alaska and to help ease the efficiency and affording heating fuel and gasoline. Most of the goods Alaskans enjoy must come through the Port of Anchorage. Vehicles, food, basic goods, and multiple of consumer products. Between 80 and 90% of Alaskan goods travel through the Port of Anchorage. And in Imanak, everything must be shipped, whether it be heating fuel, gasoline, snow machines, fishing nets, or construction supplies. These supplies originate from Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Seattle. Improved ports in Imanak and Anchorage will help bring goods into Alaska more efficiently and cost-effectively.
Okay,
although the Port of Anchorage and the U.S. Department of Maritime Administration reorganized that the Port of Anchorage is deteriorating and nearing the end of its useful life over a decade ago.
The proposed
expansion of the port has recently come under heavy criticism for its expansion and expenses. But regardless of the scope,
Mr. Moore, can I get you to finish up, please?
What is clear is that the Port of Anchorage must do something to ensure that it continues to be a functional, efficient, and effective port. Alaska depends on
it. Mr. Moore, can I get you to finish up, please?
Similarly, in Alaska, an improved port facility offers a real opportunity to bring fuel necessary goods and basic living supplies in a lower cost. An improved port.
We're going to go to the off net. We're going to go up to Hooper Bay, please. And please keep your testimony to 2 minutes. Bosco Olson, please.
Hello?
Yes, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, this is Bosco Olson, Senior City Administrator for City of Hooper Bay. I'd like to testify on Senate Bill 163, Extension to Monarch Extension Road, and it costs $703,000. It's about 1.2 feet long from the south side to the slough. And this road is needed for the better half of the community of Hooper Bay, including the Hooper Bay School. The current road is not all built all the way down to the slough, and this is needed when subsistence activities occurs. And this would be really appreciated by half of the community and the Hooper Bay schools once this road is completed. And also a small boat harbor, which is about $8.5 million. During the spring and fall seasons, when we have flood, especially during the fall seasons, the small boat harbor is needed to keep boats safe from fall storms, especially during the month of September and October, now that our bay doesn't freeze over as early as in years past. Sometimes we have two or three fall storms during the fall, and this boat harbor would be a big help for the community that easily lose a boat or two during the fall season, flood season.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Olson.
All right, Quiana.
Okay. We're now going to go back to the Anchorage LIO. There's a couple more people that want to testify. Please keep your comments to 2 minutes. Wilbur, looks like Hooch.
Yes, this is Wilbur Hooch, representing Imanac as mayor. In improving Imanac Port could also facilitate a possible LNG pipeline to Imanac as part of the ADI. The most critical issues of rural Alaska is energy cost. For Imanac and Lower Yukon regions, a solution to the crippling energy crisis would be an invaluable pursuit for generations to come. The possibility of LNG pipeline providing spur lines to remote communities is a true solution to unsustainable reliance of heating oil. It could also promote export of liquefied natural gas to Asia markets and the Lower 48. We urge you to make rural areas like Imanac part of the long-range plan now. In sum, ensuring the Alaskan goods are bought in an efficient and cost-effective manner is critical to the continued survival of Alaska. Anchorage is a starting point, and the Alaska region ports are the tributaries of the flow of affordable goods throughout Alaska. Imanac can serve as an economic connection between Anchorage and Fairbanks if the port and liquefied natural gas pipelines are developed. But Alaska ports and resources must continue to work together and develop these ports. Must become a priority. Thank you. I will be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today. Next up, Gordon Severson.
Yes, I represent Michael L. Foster and Associates in Eagle River, Alaska, and I'm here on behalf of the city of Imanac Port and Dock Facility.
Gordon, could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Gordon Severson. I'm with Michael.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
Go ahead. Okay.
All right. Hi, my name is Gordon Severson. I'm with Michael L. Foster and Associates. I am here representing the City of Imanac Port and Dock Facility Project, and wanted to say that in 2009, there were a total of 80 barges that arrived in Imanac, which offloaded and unloaded 1,500 containers. The Imanac dock area is very congested, very tiny area, and it needs significant improvements to cut down on bank erosion. There is very much an informal way to offload the barges and whatnot, and that needs to be corrected. There's a total, as had been said before, $16.5 million to cover the barge landing and the docking facility. That's it.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today. Next up, we'll go to the off-net. Jumo Stewart, please. Fairbanks.
Hello. Mr. Chairman, this is Jomo Stewart. I'm calling from Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm calling from the Office of the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation, but I'm a bit off-res, sir, if you don't mind, so I'd like to speak just as a citizen. Thank you. Again, my name is Jomo Stewart, and I'm up in Fairbanks, and I know it's a little odd. I'm testifying on a geo bond for ports, but when this bill was first proposed, I took it upon myself to go ahead and do a review of statute. And it appears that the only definition of port in the entire body of statute is means a facility of transportation-related commerce located within the state. There are other definitions of port within statute, Title 30, under transportation facilities, projects, and ports. It's a more classic definition, more aquatic. But again, the actual definition of port within statute is a fairly broad one. Again, means a facility of transportation-related commerce located within the state. With a large GO bond meant to do large projects across the state, and with so many other testifiers speaking of their energy requirements and their dilemma getting by under these high costs of energy, I couldn't help myself but wonder if there wasn't a way that we might be able to assist Fairbanks, the second largest community in the state, with its crippling energy needs. I also took the liberty of looking through the capital budget and realized that the only two direct appropriations regarding energy and possibly building a better mousetrap for Fairbanks were continued study of gas distribution within town, thank you very, very much, and also $3 million for conversion of wood stoves. But recent data provided to the Fair Mission Norristown Borough indicates that, in fact, the very thing that people are doing to try to hedge themselves against the crushingly high cost of oil is they're switching to wood, which is contributing to our PM2.5 problems. So, again, the very thing that we're doing to try to help our pocketbooks is, in fact, killing our citizenry. So I would like to see, again, if perhaps, with such a wide definition, knowing that an LNG facility on the North Slope, producing LNG and put on tankers brought down to Fairbanks to increase our energy diversity, could also be placed on barges that might go down the river system to help some of these other communities, or all the way down the road system to Fairbanks and then to the rails and offer transport through aquatic means, that perhaps a solution or a beginning of a solution for Fairbanks' energy problems might be able to fall under this broad heading of a transportation-related facility for commerce. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes the off-net and LIOs, and we have nobody signed up to testify in the room here. So that will conclude our public hearing portion. Come back to the committee. The committee have any questions? And with that, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review, and we're going to have a brief at ease. We're going to bring up now Senate Bill 192, the Oil and Gas Production Tax. With us today is representation from PFC Energy. If Mr. Mayor could go ahead and introduce himself for the record, who he represents, and then there's some slides, some conversation that we can have here today that because he wasn't able to participate Friday. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Janek Mayer. I am a manager in the upstream and gas practice of PFC Energy and project manager for this engagement that we are undertaking for the Alaska State Legislature, providing analytical support for the legislature as it considers issues of oil and gas fiscal terms reform. I wanted to present just a few slides this afternoon to go over a couple of issues, in part arising, I think, from questions that senators had from some of the slides that I presented last week, as well as from some of the testimony that senators heard on Friday, to address a few questions that I think senators may have regarding some of that. What I wanted to start off with is a discussion of this question of costs and of sensitivity of SB committee substitute for Senate Bill 192, as it's being considered at the moment, to different costs by producers. This is something that the both Department of Revenue and BP in particular discussed on Friday as part of their testimony. BP, in discussing this, discussed it by putting this particular chart on the screen. This is a PFC chart that we presented before the committee on Tuesday last week, I think on April the 3rd. And what it shows is exactly this issue, that the impact of this system is one that varies depending on the level of costs that a producer has. The chart, as it's shown here, is the slide taken directly from what was shown last Tuesday. As a result, it's out of date slightly, and that what has happened since then, of course, is that we have increased progressivity at the committee's wishes from 0.25 to 0.27. So in that sense, if one were to redraw this chart today, we would see the red line at the $12 barrel OPEX curve being completely revenue neutral in comparison to ACES at 100, that is to say, at the zero line, and then the subsequent bump, I think, one of the folks from BP testifying referred to that as a dolphin fin, rising even further in that sort of $80 to $130, $140 range as a result of that change in progressivity. Now, there are a couple of things that one should note about this. First of all, the sensitivity is particularly done on OPEX rather than CAPEX, or OPEX and CAPEX, because that's where the greatest sensitivity lies. There are two reasons for that. One is the impact of the capital credit, which goes some way to dilute that effect on CAPEX, though it still exists on capital expenditure. The other is the question of significant new and particular high cost per barrel capital expenditure is presumably something that occurs to bring online new production in some form, whether that's new areas or incremental production out of new fields. And so in considering the impact of CAPEX, one also wants to think about the impact of the production that comes from that CAPEX and the reduced rates of tax under CSSB 192 for incremental and new production. So the sensitivity is can be considered in its purest form, looking just at the question of operating costs, and that in particular I think was the issue that was of most concern to BP in their testimony on Friday, which is twofold. One, that this is a system that has been calibrated to be revenue neutral at average finding costs, average operating costs as forecast by Department of Revenue for 2013, in order for the system as a whole to be revenue neutral at $100 a barrel in 2013. Now, what that means, given this question of sensitivity to costs, is if one's per barrel operating costs are lower than that, then one has a lower tax than one has under ACES in that circumstance. If one has operating costs significantly above $12 a barrel in 2013, one has a higher tax burden than one currently has under ACES in that environment. The point that BP made, which I certainly concur with, is that if one assumes that operating costs are not purely variable on a dollar per barrel basis, but in fact tend more to be fixed. That is to say, as production declines, operating costs per barrel may increase, then this analysis, which looks only at 2013, a producer who currently has a $12 barrel a day operating cost, and thus in that sense no difference at $100 a barrel effectively between ACES and the tax liability under CSSB 192. If those costs rise as production falls, that again is a tax increase on the basis of that rising operating cost. Now, some of this comes directly from one of the things that the committee wanted to consider in this regard, which is the question of how one structures a tax so that there is more incentive for cost control and less of what has been suggested by some people to be the excessive levels of support for spending that one sees at high levels of progressivity because of the interaction of progressivity with full capital deductibility under the current system. Under the current system, if one has triggered progressivity and has a tax rate, let's say, of 35-40% under the ACES production tax, for each dollar of operating or capital cost, one can deduct that not only from the production tax liability, but because production tax per barrel then decreases, that then also has a secondary impact, which is to take one further down the curve of progressivity. And the fundamental difference in that sense between CSSB 192 and ACES in that regard is that those costs are still fully deductible from the 25% production tax, but because progressivity is no longer taxed on the net, there is no longer that impact of reducing progressivity as costs escalate. So that's something we tried to make clear in testimony on April 3rd in presenting this slide, and I want to reemphasize now in case that in being brought up again in company testimony caused anyone any surprise, because it's in large part a direct function of the request to look at structures that in some way reduce that support for what may be seen as excessive support for rising costs, and increasing incentives for cost control. The direct consequence of increasing incentives for cost control is higher costs, higher taxes for those with higher costs.
Okay, and then could I get you to rerun this slide then with the current progressivity in it?
Mr. Chair, I can certainly do that.
And I'd suggest that we put footnotes on it so we can keep them straight, what's actually in the slides.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. To address two additional points on that, there is, of course, one very significant form of mitigation in CSSB 192 in addressing this, which is the question of the reduced rates of production tax, or particularly to, reduced rates of the progressive tax on gross that occurs for both for new production, for, as in production from new areas, and for incremental production above any currently producing company's decline curve has forecast into the future. So in that sense, and this is in particular is where that question of CapEx comes in, for companies, and the clearest example is for a company newly producing from a completely new area, there is, of course, that much lower level of a total 5%, at least for the first 7 years, under CSSB 192, and that goes a significant way to mitigating the impact of some of this. The fact that it only lasts for 7 years, however, limits the mitigation. The impact of this, and in particular the fact that new production is where we see the highest costs, is, for example, one of the reasons that in discussing this at this table and in other conversations with senators, I've been particularly adamant, for instance, that if one were to move to such a structure, it's particularly important, for instance, to make sure that recently completed developments like Nikaichek or Ogurek are also included in that sense under the system for new production, precisely because their costs are very high, and were they to face, for example, the full rate as calibrated here to be revenue neutral, $12 a barrel in OPEX, their costs are far above that, and they in particular would face a significant tax increase. The effect of including them in that sense in the new production category is to bring that tax rate down significantly for the first 7 years. For some of them, that may still actually in 2013 not be a tax decrease. I imagine there are. It's entirely possible that such projects could still have sufficient ongoing drilling costs that they essentially don't trigger progressivity at the moment. I can't comment on that since I don't have access to that sort of individual taxpayer data. But over the course of 7 years, that is a tax reduction for them. On the other hand, it's offset by, again, a tax increase after that seven-year period as the full rate then kicks in. And if one wanted to mitigate the impact of that further, one could extend the impact of that seven-year period further or not limit it at all. Similarly, one could mitigate that impact for the high-cost new fields by further reducing the progressivity that they face or taking it out altogether and having them only face the base tax. Those same things apply to what will certainly be high-cost new production in the existing fields as well, what we refer to as incremental production from the existing fields. Similarly, in that sense, part of the design here is that for production above an existing decline curve, that is to say, above the level of investment that is going on today, that is economic under the current ACES regime, that there is a reduced rate of tax, both to address this question of the impact of higher costs under this system and also to provide incentive to encourage that new investment to make it more economic. Once again, that's a mitigating fact in considering the impact of higher costs under this system, and if one wished to go further with that, that's entirely possible to do through this structure in the ways that I just outlined. Finally, I wanted to address one related point on that, which was the conclusion that in Department of Revenue testimony that was drawn from this was that sensitivity to higher costs essentially meant that this was a regime that encouraged further retreat into sort of harvest mode. That is to say, because in particular a company could face a lower tax rate by having lower costs that disincentivized harvest production. I think there are, while I certainly don't dispute the numbers the Department of Revenue showed in that regard, that yes, as we see on this slide, having lower costs leads to a lower tax rate, there are two reasons why I would not draw the conclusion from that encourages a harvest mode. One relates back to the testimony that the BP gave at the time, which was exactly that question of, as production falls, operating costs in particular are more likely to stay flat, and in that sense, cost per barrel as production falls are likely to rise. So in that sense, harvest mode, particularly from a lifting cost perspective, from an operating cost perspective, does not imply low cost per barrel. In that sense, actually quite the opposite. As production falls, if anything, costs per barrel rise. And the second question comes back again to that impact of CapEx, which is to say, yes, for a producer with lower rather than higher CapEx, once again, the tax treatment of that CapEx for existing production is not as strongly supported as it is under ACES. On the other hand, that new CapEx creates new production, which under the system would be taxed at the lower rate, and that also needs to be taken into account. And that distinction wasn't drawn in some of the testimony on Friday. Finally, in terms of that question of whether or not this sensitivity incentivizes harvest production, the third thing to say there is, of course, tax rate is one thing, but production volumes and revenue from production volumes are still far more significant, and it would take an extraordinary reduction in tax to make any producer deliberately want to produce less than they are able to, achieve less revenue than they are able to, particularly if their costs are not going to decrease at the same time. So that's an important note to make in considering the question of incentives. To move on to the second slide, Mr. Chair, and this deals with a related issue. I think there are a couple of questions about numbers shown in slides on April 4th and April 5th about levels of government take for new development under the system. I think the source for confusion is the slide in the bottom left from April 4th showing sort of government take in the mid-60s level for new production versus that on the top right from the following day on the benchmarking exercise showing it instead more in the mid-70s level. Now, the reason for this is quite straightforward. It's the difference between financial year 2013 analysis and life cycle analysis. For almost the entirety of last week and before that, we've been looking and been directed to look in that sense at cash on the table in 2013. That's a direct function of being asked to look at this in terms of how cash moves in 2013 and the task of making this revenue neutral in 2013 at a particular price level, in this case $100 a barrel. So all that analysis last week, including these slides, and you'll note it says on the slide that it's percentages of financial year 2013 government take, and that similarly consistent with the methodology we've applied throughout this means assuming Department of Revenue costs for 2013, that's those average costs that apply across the slope. At the end of the week, in the final deck of slides we showed, we were also asked to include the analysis that we've shown many times before of that sort of benchmarking exercise of how some of these things compare for existing producers, for new producers, based on that sort of benchmarking ranking we've used a number of times before. That inherently is a life cycle analysis that we do in that ranking. It has been every time we've presented it. And when one looks at it on a life cycle basis, there are two differences. One, every time we've done this analysis in the past and looking at a new development, we've used those sort of generic new development costs as opposed to the North Slope average cost for 2013, and again, consistent with what I've just been saying about the impact of rising costs, those higher costs move the take upward. And then there's another thing that significantly moves the take upward, which is that if one is looking at this only on a 2013 basis, one gets the full impact of the fact that one is, for new production, at that lowest rate of progressivity capped at 5%. if one is looking at this across a life cycle, one has that benefit for 5 years, for 7 years, sorry, and then after that one goes to the higher tax rate, which as we see in this sense is a tax increase. Now, the overall impact of that benefit for 7 years is to bring the level of government take down from what it is under ACES, and that's what we saw in that chart, but it brings it down into the mid-70s, not down to the mid-60s, as it does if one looks at it on a 2013 basis and assumes Department of Revenue 2013 costs. That's the difference between those two slides.
So one's run on full cycle new production, the other one's run on the FY13 blended numbers?
That's exactly correct, Mr. Chair.
So we're clear, then the chart on the lower left hand is the life cycle, the other one's the FY13?
The competitiveness ranking is life cycle. The chart on the bottom left, as in fact is stated in the table, is, yes, FY2013 Department of Revenue figures.
I think maybe what we'll do going forward is when we do life cycle, we can always maybe note that in the footnotes, because as people flip through these and we change them, and because it just creates a lot of confusion.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent idea, and my apologies for not having pointed that out clearly enough at the time. Similarly, on that note, it's probably worth noting in that sense, we had an issue in the course of the week last week where those financial year 2013 numbers that we were looking at in the CSSB 192 case dropped by about $200 million, and I talked about that at the time. I just wanted to come back and clarify once again. What changed there was nothing fundamental in terms of the way anything was modeled. It's simply a question of better understanding how it is the Department of Revenue account for costs when they make their own cost assumptions that they put in the Department of Revenue Revenue Sources Handbook, which is to say that operating costs, as they quote them, are inclusive of property tax. And it's simply that one change that caused that shift in the numbers, that as soon as I was able to get a copy of the Department of Revenue model and look through it in a little more detail, that difference became apparent through conversations that I had with a number of the producers. And as soon as that became apparent, I put that in to make sure that we were all dealing on the same basis.
Okay. Senator Olson, have a question?
No.
Okay.
Finally, I just wanted to conclude that with that question of considering that testimony, both of what I covered on Tuesday last week and today, and what you heard from a number of the companies and Department of Revenue testimony on Friday, the fundamental with that question of the possibility of an increased tax burden under this system for some taxpayers. The fundamental issue here is that some goals are mutually exclusive. There's a list of things here that the one would like to do, and one can do some of them, but one can't do all of them. On the one hand, we said, you know, one would like to achieve decoupling. There's been a desire expressed to reduce some of the high levels of support that exist under ACES for spending and for incentives for cost control. One of the desires that's been expressed is to minimize complexity, particularly, for instance, the question, and this is integral to the question of decoupling, of the need for separate cost accounting for different streams of production. One of the goals has been to reduce government take, in particular, on new and incremental production to provide an incentive for new and incremental production. There's presumably an implicit goal of not increasing taxes on any existing taxpayers. A very firmly articulated goal of the committee has been that things, this should be revenue neutral at $100 a barrel. And one of the goals that's been articulated is that there should be more even split between the state and companies above that sort of $100 to $120 a barrel range. Now, if those are the goals, we can achieve some of those with any given tax structure, but they can't all be achieved with any single tax structure. If we think about the simplest intervention one could have, simply taking ACES exactly as it currently is and changing just one thing, which is the percentage figure 75 to 40 when it comes to the question of the cap on progressivity. Well, we wouldn't achieve decoupling if we did that. we wouldn't address those issues of high levels of support for spending or the impact that has on the state. We wouldn't reduce government take on newer incremental production or have any impact on newer incremental production beyond the question of sort of fixing the split at $100 or so a barrel, which would be achieved. It would be, however, no increase on existing taxpayers, and it would be basically revenue neutral at $100 a barrel. If we wanted to then add sort of decoupling as done, for instance, in Senate Bill 305 from the previous session, that would achieve decoupling. It would be revenue neutral at $100 a barrel, and it would similarly even that split at the range the committee has sought to look at. However, it would be an increase in tax on certain taxpayers, particularly anyone that has significant expenses at the moment developing future gas production, who can currently write that off against their oil tax production tax value. And it wouldn't minimize complexity in terms of that question of separate cost accounting. If we take another comparative example in terms of HB 110, that does to some extent reduce some of the high levels of support for spending through a different means, in this case by the mechanism of bracketing reduces the marginal tax rates, and that does something to address that particular issue in a different way. This does certainly reduce government take substantially on all production, including even further on new and incremental production, though it too has its degree of complexity that comes from separate cost accounting for new fields, that comes from having a lower 15% base rate as opposed to the higher rate for all other production. It certainly has no increases on any existing taxpayers, and not only does it have that more even split above 100-120, it obviously, as we've seen, puts a lot more cash to companies at much lower levels. As a result, what it particularly doesn't do is it's certainly not, as the committee has sought to look at, revenue neutral at $100 a barrel. Finally, if we think about what committee substitute for Senate Bill 192 does, well, it does achieve decoupling. It does reduce those high levels of support for spending and those poor incentives for cost control. It does, to the extent possible, minimize some of the complexity that comes from the question of separate cost accounting. It has its own degrees of complexity that come in through the question of incentives for incremental and new production. Some of those, for instance, could be simplified if, for instance, one wasn't to have the 7-year time limit on new production. One could then apply the same rate to both the new and the incremental, and that could make some of the complexity that's added by doing that a little simpler. It does reduce government take on new and incremental production. It's a structure that has scope to significantly further reduce take on those categories than the current bill does, but that's, again, a question for the committee to determine. It is revenue neutral at $100 a barrel on the basis of FY 2013 cost projections and production projections. And it does create that more even split that the committee has sought to do above that $100, $120 a barrel level. Now, one can do all of those things, but one can't do all of those things and simultaneously have no increases on any existing taxpayers. So there are fundamental trade-offs that the committee needs to weigh and assess and think about here. As I said, one of the ways in which the impact of higher costs on the level of tax that taxpayers pay is mitigated is by the lower levels of progressive gross tax that are levied on new areas and on incremental production. One of the ways to further mitigate that would be to make the treatment of those things more generous, for instance, possibly having no progressivity on those categories of production, or having no time limit, or raising the thresholds at which progressivity on those things apply. There are a number of ways in which one could do that. The only way to further mitigate that question of not having or minimizing increases on any taxpayers is to move on that question of revenue neutrality at $100 a barrel. Those are the immovable trade-offs involved in all this that the committee needs to consider. finally, I just wanted to finish with one slide, which is, again, coming back to that question of regime competitiveness that we've shown many times here. And I wanted to address just one issue, which is that in a number of questions and comments made around the table during testimony on Friday, that there was a suggestion made a number of times that the committee's consultants had suggested either that ACES was pretty good at $100 a barrel, it was north of that where the problem lay, or perhaps around particular levels of government take, for instance, that the 75% of government take was a desirable level to achieve. I just wanted to go on the record and say I think some of that may indeed be testimony that other consultants that the committee has engaged and interacted with may have come from there. It's not something that PFC has ever said, either in formal testimony or in other interactions. I think what we've said here fairly consistently is what's shown by this slide, which is that at $100, government take under ACES is somewhere in the mid-70s, and that is very, very high by OECD standards, second only to Norway, and certainly in particular much higher than the levels of government take we see elsewhere in the lower 48, which are the places that, in particular, Alaska at the moment is competing with for investment capital. Those lower 48 states are also places with significantly lower costs in many cases, even compared with unconventional production, and that only enhances their competitiveness compared to Alaska. Norway, by contrast, as a benchmark, has not only an active national oil company, but active equity participation by the state through another vehicle, Petoro, and is far more able to ensure constant ongoing investment in its oil sector through those vehicles than a state that doesn't have those things has. So, you know, we deliberately haven't set a particular target rate at which ACES works or ACES doesn't, or a particular level of government take that the state should seek to achieve. What we have said is, particularly for new investment where costs are very high and projects are economically challenged, there needs to be significant movement in government take to enable those to occur and to be incentivized. There are a number of ways of doing that. One can simply reduce government take overall, as HB 110 by and large does, or one can try to reduce government take in more targeted ways on incremental production and production from new areas. There are costs and benefits to both of those approaches. Having an overall reduction is a simpler approach that means that one doesn't deal with some of the complexities that one deals with when trying to figure out, you know, decline curves and all the other things that we've been discussing in the last week or two. However, the cost of that simplicity is that one has to move a lot of cash across the table to incentivize the new production, because one is also providing a lot of benefit for activity that is currently economic under the current system. If one isn't to do that, then one has to find a way of specifically incentivizing new projects, incremental production from existing fields, and to do that, one encounters some of the complexity that we've been discussing over the course of the last 2 weeks.
Okay, we have any questions for Janik this afternoon? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to make sure I understood your page 2 chart. I see the relationship, obviously, at, say, today's prices of $120 a barrel, and I see the movement from operating expenditures of $24 a barrel versus 12, but I'm not sure which way that's going in relationship to ACES and the progressive severance option, I guess. Certainly. Not sure which one's on the top and which one's on the bottom, I guess.
Senator Thomas, through the chair. So the horizontal axis there is set at the zero level, and what we're seeing is the difference between ACES and CSSV 192 at different price levels and different OPEX assumptions. So, for example, at the $100 barrel level, and again, this has changed since then because of the change in progressivity that's been made from 0.25 to 0.27, but in this example, simply read this chart. So the $12 barrel is that red line, which at $12 barrel capex is that red line, which at $100 barrel oil is below that zero line. So in this case, it's a revenue decrease or tax decrease on existing taxpayers that would now, in fact, be practically zero under the 0.27, the progressivity that's been changed to. Every point above that, in particular, every point above that zero line is a point where, at which one has a tax increase compared to ACEs.
Okay, thank you. That's what I thought it meant. And one other, if I may? I'm trying to read literally slide 8, bullet number 2. I'm wanting to know if that's a positive or a negative statement. I suppose it depends on which side you're on, but I would look at it. It says reduces, as the chart also says, uses the word reduces high levels of support for spending. So I'm wanting to put a word or two in that first part of the sentence to understand it better. And I'm looking at it saying reduces high levels of support from the industry for spending. Is that what you're saying?
High levels of support from the state to the industry in the form of
increased investment.
But in particular, the question of for each additional dollar spent by the industry, how much in the form of change in government take,
right,
effectively on an after-tax cash flow basis, comes from the state.
So, if I may, I'm still trying to get it clear in my mind. When it says reduce high levels of support for spending, you're saying incrementally then as money is expended, CSS, Community Subset for Senate Bill 192, decreases industry's portion. So would then reduce their high levels of support for spending then in that case.
It's the gold plating issue.
Yes, I'm just
dollars, so we can't be put in a position where we would be subsidizing capital expenditures close to 100%, or in some examples above 100%.
Correct.
Right, and Janik, I think that's kind of what you're trying to explain here.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Perhaps a clear way of phrasing it would be to say increasing the marginal, I don't have a particularly clear way of expressing it, Senator Thomas, through the chair, but moving from a situation where the fractional amount on the dollar for each additional dollar of capex spent by a company is relatively low to one where that is higher.
I thought I understood it that way because the second part of the sentence says, and poor incentives for cost control, so it was, I got you. Thank you.
We have any other questions for Jack? Seeing none, that will conclude today's meeting. We'll put out the schedule later today. We are adjourned.